Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. Welcome to Send Me to Sleep, the place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell, chapters 47 and 48. In the last chapter, Margaret had confessed her lie to Mr. Bell and asked that he should pass it on to Mr. Thornton if the opportunity arose. In these chapters, Dixon arrives at Harley Street. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath, and settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy and your breath soften as we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 47. Something Wanting. Experience, like a pale musician, holds a dulcimer of patience in its hand, whence harmonies we cannot understand, of God's will in his worlds, the strain unfolds in sad, perplexed minors. Mrs. Browning. About this time, Dixon returned from Milton and assumed her post as Margaret's maid. She brought endless pieces of Milton gossip. How Martha had gone to live with Miss Thornton on the latter's marriage, with an account of the bridesmaids, dresses, and breakfasts at that interesting ceremony. How people thought that Mr. Thornton had made too grand a wedding of it, considering he had lost a deal by the strike, and had had to pay so much for the failure of his contracts. How little money articles of furniture, long cherished by Dixon, had fetched at the sale, which was a shame, considering how rich folks were at Milton. How Mrs. Thornton had come one day and got two or three good bargains, and Mr. Thornton had come the next, and in his desire to obtain one or two things, had bid against himself, much to the enjoyment of the bystanders, so as Dixon observed, that made things even. If Mrs. Thornton paid too little, Mr. Thornton paid too much. Mr. Bell had sent all sorts of orders about the books. There was no understanding him. He was so particular. If he had come himself, it would have been all right. But letters always were, and always will be, more puzzling than they are worth. Dixon had not much to tell about the Higginses. Her memory had an aristocratic bias, and was very treacherous whenever she tried to recall any circumstance connected with those below her in life. Nicholas was very well, she believed. He had been several times at the house, asking for news of Miss Margaret. The only person who ever did ask, except once Mr. Thornton. And Mary, oh, of course she was very well, a great, stout, slatternly thing. She did hear, or perhaps it was only a dream of hers, though it would be strange if she had dreamt of such people as the Higginses, that Mary had gone to work at Mr. Thornton's mill, because her father wished her to know how to cook. But what nonsense that could mean, she didn't know. Margaret rather agreed with her that the story was incoherent enough to be like a dream. Still, it was pleasant to have someone now with whom she could talk of Milton and Milton people. Dixon was not overfond of the subject, rather wishing to leave that part of her life in shadow. She liked much more to dwell upon speeches of Mr. Bell's, which had suggested an idea to her of what was really his intention, making Margaret his heiress. But her young lady gave her no encouragement, nor in any way gratified her insinuating inquiries, however disguised in the form of suspicions or assertions. All this time, Margaret had a strange, undefined longing to hear that Mr. Bell had gone to pay one of his business visits to Milton, for it had been well understood between them at the time of their conversation at Helston that the explanation he had desired should only be given to Mr. Thornton by word of mouth, and even in that manner should be in no wise forced upon him. Mr. Bell was no great correspondent, but he wrote from time to time, long or short letters, as the humour took him, and although Margaret was not conscious of any definite hope on receiving them, yet she always put away his notes with a little feeling of disappointment. He was not going to Milton. He said nothing about it, at any rate. Well, she must be patient. Sooner or later, the mists would be cleared away. Mr. Bell's letters were hardly like his usual self. They were short and complaining, with every now and then a little touch of bitterness that was unusual. He did not look forward to the future. He rather seemed to regret the past and be weary of the present. Margaret fancied that he could not be well, but in answer to some inquiry of hers as to his health, he sent her a short note, saying there was an old-fashioned complaint called the spleen, that he was suffering from that, and it was for her to decide if it was more mental or physical, but that he should like to indulge himself in grumbling without being obliged to send a bulletin every time. In consequence of this note, Margaret made no more inquiries about his health. One day, Edith let out accidentally a fragment of a conversation which she had had with Mr. Bell when he was last in London, which possessed Margaret with the idea that he had some notion of taking her to pay a visit to her brother and new sister-in-law in Cadiz in the autumn. She questioned and cross-questioned Edith till the latter was weary and declared that there was nothing more to remember. All he had said was that he half thought he should go and hear for himself what Frederick had to say about the mutiny, and that it would be a good opportunity for Margaret to become acquainted with her new sister-in-law, that he always went somewhere during the long vacation, and did not see why he should not go to Spain as well as anywhere else. That was all. Edith hoped Margaret did not want to leave them, that she was so anxious about all this. And then, having nothing else particular to do, she cried and said that she knew she cared much more for Margaret than Margaret did for her. Margaret comforted her as well as she could, but she could hardly explain to her how this idea of Spain, mere chateau en España as it might be, charmed and delighted her. Edith was in the mood to think that any pleasure enjoyed away from her was a tacit affront, or at best, a proof of indifference. So Margaret had to keep her pleasure to herself, and only let it escape by the safety valve of asking Dixon, when she dressed for dinner, if she would not like to see Master Frederick and his new wife very much indeed. "She's a Papist, miss, isn't she?" "I believe so. Oh yes, certainly," said Margaret, a little damped for an instant at the recollection. "And they live in Popish country?" "Yes." "Then I'm afraid I must say that my soul is dearer to me than even Master Frederick, his own dear self. I should be in a perpetual terror, miss, lest I should be converted." "Oh," said Margaret, "I do not know that I am going, and if I go, I am not such a fine lady as to be unable to travel without you." "No, dear old Dixon, you shall have a long holiday, if we go, but I'm afraid it is a long if." Now Dixon did not like this speech. In the first place, she did not like Margaret's trick of calling her dear old Dixon whenever she was particularly demonstrative. She knew that Miss Hale was apt to call all people that she liked old, as a sort of term of endearment. But Dixon always winced away from the application of the word to herself, who, being not much past 50, was, she thought, in the very prime of life. Secondly, she did not like being so easily taken at her word. She had, with all her terror, a lurking curiosity about Spain, the Inquisition, and Popish mysteries. So, after clearing her throat, as if to show her willingness to do away with difficulties, she asked Miss Hale whether she thought, if she took care never to see a priest or enter into one of their churches, there would be so very much danger of her being converted. Master Frederick, to be sure, had gone over unaccountably. "I fancy it was love that first predisposed him to conversion," said Margaret, sighing. "Indeed, miss," said Dixon. "Well, I can preserve myself from priests and from churches, but love steals in unawares. I think it's as well I should not go." Margaret was afraid of letting her mind run too much upon this Spanish plan, but it took off her thoughts from too impatiently dwelling upon her desire to have all explained to Mr. Thornton. Mr. Bell appeared for the present to be stationary at Oxford, and to have no immediate purpose of going to Milton, and some secret restraint seemed to hang over Margaret and prevent her from even asking or alluding again to any probability of such a visit on his part. Nor did she feel at liberty to name what Edith had told her of the idea he had entertained. It might be but for 5 minutes, of going to Spain. He had never named it at Helston, during all that sunny day of leisure. It was very probably but the fancy of a moment, But if it were true, what a bright outlet it would be from the monotony of her present life, which was beginning to fall upon her. One of the great pleasures of Margaret's life at this time was in Edith's boy. He was the pride and plaything of both father and mother, as long as he was good. But he had a strong will of his own, and as soon as he burst out into one of his stormy passions, Edith would throw herself back in despair and fatigue, and sigh out, "Oh dear, what shall I do with him? Do, Margaret, please ring the bell for Hanley." But Margaret almost liked him better in these manifestations of character than in his good, blue-sashed moods. She would carry him off into a bedroom, where they two alone battled it out, she with a firm power which subdued him into peace, while every sudden charm and wile she possessed was exerted on the side of right, until he would rub his little hot and tear-smeared face all over hers, kissing and caressing till he often fell asleep in her arms or on her shoulder. Those were Margaret's sweetest moments. They gave her a taste of the feeling that she believed she would be denied to her forever. Mr. Henry Lennox added a new and not disagreeable element to the course of household life by his frequent presence. Margaret thought him colder, if more brilliant than formerly. But there were strong intellectual tastes and much and varied knowledge which gave flavour to the otherwise rather insipid conversation. Margaret saw glimpses in him of a slight contempt for his brother and sister-in-law and for their mode of life, which he seemed to consider as frivolous and purposeless. He once or twice spoke to his brother, in Margaret's presence, in a pretty sharp tone of inquiry as to whether he meant entirely to relinquish his profession, and on Captain Lennox's reply that he had quite enough to live upon. She had seen Mr. Lennox curl of the lip as he said, "And is that all you live for?" But the brothers were much attached to each other, in the way that any two persons are, when the one is cleverer and always leads the other, and this last is patiently content to be led. Mr. Lennox was pushing on his profession, cultivating, with profound calculation, all those connections that might eventually be of service to him. Keen-sighted, far-seeing, intelligent, sarcastic and proud. Since the one long conversation relating to Frederick's affairs, which she had with him the first evening in Mr. Bell's presence, she had no great intercourse with him, further than that which arose out of their close relations with the same household. But this was enough to wear off the shyness of her side, and any symptoms of mortified pride and vanity on his. They met continually, of course, but she thought that he rather avoided being alone with her. She fancied that he, as well as she, perceived that they had drifted strangely apart from their former anchorage, side by side, in many of their opinions and all their tastes. And yet, when he had spoken unusually well, or with remarkable epigrammatic point, she felt that his eye sought the expression of her countenance first of all, if but for an instant, and that, in the family intercourse which constantly threw them together, her opinion was the one to which he listened with a deference. the more complete, because it was reluctantly paid and concealed as much as possible. Chapter 48. Never to be found again. My own, my father's friend, I cannot part with thee. I never have shown, thou never hast known, how dear thou art to me. Anon. The elements of the dinner parties which Mrs. Lennox gave were these. Her friends contributed the beauty, Captain Lennox the easy knowledge of the subjects of the day, and Mr. Henry Lennox, and the sprinkling of rising men who were received as his friends, brought the wit, the cleverness, the keen and extensive knowledge of which they knew well how to avail themselves without seeming pedantic or burdening the rapid flow of conversation. These dinners were delightful, but even here Margaret's dissatisfaction found her out. Every talent, every feeling, every acquirement, nay, even every tendency towards virtue, was used up as materials for fireworks. The hidden, sacred fire exhausted itself in sparkle and crackle. They talked about art in a merely sensuous way, dwelling on outside effects instead of allowing themselves to learn what it has to teach. They lashed themselves up into an enthusiasm about high subjects in company, and never thought about them when they were alone. They squandered their capabilities of appreciation into a mere flow of appropriate words. One day, after the gentlemen had come up into the drawing room, Mr. Lennox drew near to Margaret and addressed her in almost the first voluntary words he had spoken to her since she had returned to live at Harley Street. You did not look pleased at what Shirley was saying at dinner. Didn't I? My face must be very expressive, replied Margaret. It always was. It has not lost the trick of being eloquent. It has not lost the trick of being eloquent. I did not like, said Margaret hastily, his way of advocating what he knew to be wrong, so glaringly wrong, even in jest. But it was clever, how every word told. Did you remember the happy epithets? Yes. And despite them, you would like to add, pray don't scruple, though he is my friend. There, that is the exact tone in you. She stopped short. She listened for a moment to see if she would finish her sentence, but she only reddened and turned away. Before she did so, however, she heard him say, in a very low, clear voice, if my tones or modes of thought are what you dislike, will you do me the justice to tell me so, and so give me the chance of learning to please you? All these weeks, there was no intelligence of Mr. Bell's going to Milton. He had spoken of it at Helston as a journey which he might have to take in a very short time from then. But he must have transacted his business by writing. Margaret thought, ere now, and she knew that if he could, he would avoid going to a place which he disliked, and moreover, would little understand the secret importance which she affixed to the explanation that could only be given by word of mouth. She knew that he would feel that it was necessary that it should be done, but whether in summer, autumn, or winter, it would signify very little. It was now August, and there had been no mention of the Spanish journey to which he had alluded to Edith, and Margaret tried to reconcile herself to the fading away of this illusion. But one morning, she received a letter saying that next week he meant to come up to town. He wanted to see her about a plan which he had in his head, and moreover, he intended to treat himself to a little doctoring, as he had begun to come round to her opinion that it would be pleasanter to think that his health was more in fault than he, when he found himself irritable and cross. There was altogether a tone of forced cheerfulness in the letter, as Margaret noticed afterwards, but at the time her attention was taken up by Edith's exclamations. "Coming up to town, oh dear, and I'm so worn out by the heat that I don't believe I have enough strength in me for another dinner. Besides, everybody has left but our dear, stupid selves, who can't settle where to go to. There would be nobody to meet him. I'm sure he would much rather come and dine with us quite alone than with most agreeable strangers you could pick up. Besides, if he is not well, he won't wish for invitations. I'm glad he has owned it at last. I was sure he was ill from the whole tone of his letters, and yet he would not answer me when I asked him, and I had no third person to whom I could apply for news. Oh, he is not very ill, or he would not think of Spain. He never mentioned Spain. No, but his plan that is to be proposed evidently relates to that. But would you really go in such weather as this? Oh, it will get cooler every day. Yes, think of it. I'm only afraid I have thought and wished too much, in that absorbing, willful way, which is sure to be disappointed, or else gratified, to the letter, while in the spirit it gives no pleasure. But that's superstitious, I'm sure, Margaret. No, I don't think it is. Only it ought to warn me and check me from giving way to such passionate wishes. It is a sort of give me children or else I die. I'm afraid my cry is, let me go to Cadiz or else I die. My dear Margaret, you'll be persuaded to stay there, and then what shall I do? Oh, I wish I could find somebody for you to marry here, that I could be sure of you. I shall never marry. Nonsense, and double nonsense. Why, as Sholto says, you're such an attraction to the house that he knows ever so many men who will be glad to visit here next year for your sake. Margaret drew herself up haughtily. Do you know, Edith, I sometimes think your Corfu life has taught you... Well, just a shade or two of coarseness. Edith began to sob bitterly, and so bitterly, to declare so vehemently that Margaret had lost all love for her, and no longer looked upon her as a friend, that Margaret came to think that she had expressed too harsh an opinion for the relief of her own wounded pride, and ended by being Edith's slave for the rest of the day, while that little lady, overcome by wounded feeling, lay like a victim on the sofa, heaving occasionally a profound sigh, till at last she fell asleep. Mr. Bell did not make his appearance, even on the day to which he had, for a second time, deferred his visit. The next morning, there came a letter from Wallace, his servant, stating that his master had not been feeling well for some time, which had been the true reason of his putting off his journey, and that the very time when he should have set out for London, he had been seized with an apoplectic fit. It was, indeed, Wallace added, the opinion of the medical men that he could not survive the night, and more than probable that by the time Miss Hale received this letter, his poor master would be no more. Margaret received this letter at breakfast time, and turning very pale as she read it, then, silently putting into Edith's hands, she left the room. Edith was terribly shocked as she read it, and cried in a sobbing, frightened, childish way, much to her husband's distress. Mrs. Shaw was breakfasting in her own room, and upon him devolved the task of reconciling his wife to the near contact into which she seemed to be brought with death, for the first time that she could remember in her life. Here was a man who was to have dined with them today, lying dead or dying instead. It was some time before she could think of Margaret. Then she started up and followed her upstairs into her room. Dixon was packing up a few toilet articles, and Margaret was hastily putting on her bonnet, shedding tears all the time, and her hands trembling so that she could hardly tie the strings. "Oh, dear Margaret, how shocking. What are you doing? Are you going out? Sholto would telegraph or do anything you like." "I'm going to Oxford. There is a train in half an hour. Dixon has offered to go with me, but I could have gone myself. I must see him again. Besides, he may be better and want some care. He has been like a father to me. Don't stop me, Edith." "But I must. Mama won't like it at all. Come and ask her about it, Margaret. You don't know where you're going. I should not mind if he had a house of his own, but in his fellow's rooms. Come to Mama and do ask her before you go. It will not take a minute." Margaret yielded and lost her train. In the suddenness of the event, Mrs. Shaw became bewildered and hysterical, and so the precious time slipped by. But there was another train in a couple of hours, and after various discussions on propriety and impropriety, it was decided that Captain Lennox should accompany Margaret, as the one thing to which she was constant was her resolution to go, alone or otherwise, by the next train, whatever might be said of the propriety or impropriety of the step. Her father's friend, her own friend, was lying at the point of death, and the thought of this came upon her with such vividness that she was surprised herself at the firmness with which she asserted something of her right to independence of an action. And 5 minutes before the time of starting, she found herself sitting in a railway carriage opposite to Captain Lennox. It was always a comfort to her to think that she had gone, though it was only to hear that he had died in the night. She saw the rooms that he occupied and associated them ever after most fondly in her memory with the idea of her father and his one cherished and faithful friend. They had promised Edith before starting that if all had ended as they feared, they would return to dinner. So that long, lingering look around the room in which her father had died had to be interrupted, and a quiet farewell taken of the kind old face that had so often come out with pleasant words and merry quips and cranks. Captain Lennox fell asleep on their journey home, and Margaret could cry at leisure and bethink her of this fatal year and all the woes it had brought to her. No sooner was she fully aware of one loss than another came, not to supersede her grief for the one before, but to reopen wounds and feeling scarcely healed. But at the sound of the tender voices of her aunt and Edith, of merry little Sholto's glee at her arrival, and at the sight of the well-lighted rooms with their mistress, pretty in her paleness and her eager, sorrowful interest, Margaret roused herself from her heavy trance of almost superstitious hopelessness, and began to feel that, even around her, joy and gladness might gather. She had Edith's place on the sofa. Sholto was taught to carry Aunt Margaret's cup of tea very carefully to her, and by the time she went up to dress, she could thank God for having spared her dear old friend a long or a painful illness.